is a cell site. If it was just a single carrier, okay, like a TV station or a radio station, it would probably be invisible to the chip that they're using. There's a couple of questions one needs to ask. The protocol between the transmitter and receiver, is there some kind of additional FEC correction in terms of control? Is it now, are we messing up the data stream, or are we making the signal completely go away? So you got to ask the question, what are we transmitting? Are we transmitting ODFM or QAM, or are we transmitting direct sequence spread spectrum? Direct sequence spread spectrum, it's all over the place, but if you're swamping the front end with a lot of energy, now when you think of a cell site transmitting a lot of energy, it's not a lot of energy on one frequency, it's across a 30 megahertz worth of band space. I mean, Wi-Fi channels are 30 megahertz wide and they overlap with each other. So there are things like these transmitters that they use on traffic lights and things like that, where they actually go beyond the limits in terms of power, and they tend to do direct sequence spectrum, and they can cause different kinds of interference. If you've got a certain kind of control in your data system, like forward error correction or read Solomon, you can eliminate a lot of that. So what I'm seeing from the Wi-Fi chips themselves, they're basically stupid. So, you know, there's a lot of questions to be asked here.
If you were a radio control flyer, what would you do next, Eric? I think the answer is, for the time being, you have to stop using Futaba Fast System. Well, Futaba is admitting there's a problem with Fast, and even though it may be your favorite RC transmitter, I think you got to stop using it, because the chances of getting the new service to stop using that service when they've already made a big investment in it, I think that's a long shot. So I think you've got very few choices as an RC flyer here. Over to you, Eric, for any comments. K2RAW and the TechNet.
Now, you've got to remember that the mobile companies have bought all of the old TV frequencies from channel, 48 and up. They belong to the phone companies, so I wouldn't be surprised if you're dealing with harmonics that are being transmitted from way down low, winding up there, having an awful lot of energy. Me, personally, I'm probably, and I've done a lot of RC stuff in my younger days. If I were going to do it again today, I definitely wouldn't use Wi-Fi, and I definitely wouldn't use the free bands, because you get a lot of company.
Some of these modern spread spectrum RC systems, though, Eric, are so sophisticated, working so well. You go to a neat fair, and you see 40 guys flying their aircraft simultaneously during one of these simulated wartime situations. 40, 45 aircraft flying simultaneously, all on the 2.4 gig band at the same time. And they seem to have no interference between those individual aircraft. The only problem is you and your spotter have to keep track of where all the other aircraft are in the sky and try to avoid having direct collisions, if you know what I mean. So these modern-day systems are working so well. I mean, you would be tempted, you and I in the old days would be tempted to go over to ham radio frequencies. Well, you may find that the ham radio frequencies are more vulnerable than these new 2.4 gig spread spectrum systems. K2RIW listening.
Did you by any chance see the, I think it's on YouTube now also, there's a little documentary that was done, I think we did, with Intel, and the little drone copters with lights on it. They were used in China to make the Olympics in the sky, and they've done quite a number of things. And he talks about the technical problems that they had having, you know, 300 or 400 drones flying at the same time, all in synchronism with each other, and they wound up using the chips inside each one of them as a repeater for the guy next door, so to speak. So, I mean, there's a lot of technology there. It's interesting. Also, with the amount of reaction time that you need, to be able to control the devices, you know, you could be talking microseconds, a hundred of a microseconds in terms of wanting to make actuation. So you need bandwidth. So a typical Wi-Fi channel is 30 megahertz wide, and you use all of it. So there's places that I would go, just not where everybody else is, and that way nobody can point one of those stupid things, stupid guns at it, and make it die.
This is Mark, another question.
Go ahead, Mark.
One of the members of the club bought a spectrum analyzer trying to find the frequency, you know, trying to find the noise that's causing the grief. And he didn't find, I don't think, anything in the 2.4 gigahertz range. But from what you guys, I think, are saying is, if there was a problem with a harmonic, we wouldn't notice it trying to look for the 2.4 gigahertz signal. Is that right?
Well, first of all, I would have difficulty believing that you can actually see all the activity on a spectrum analyzer. Because your spectrum analyzer has to make a sweep. And if the stuff is operating in DSSS, that's little pips all over the place. It's going to look like noise to you. It's not going to look like a signal like you would be expecting for a carrier.
There are some very fancy spectrum analyzers that try to take very low probability of intercept signals, like a direct sneak and spread spectrum signal. And with all kinds of memory devices and a display matrix, it manages to make it record on the screen. Under ordinary circumstances, your eye is not going to see the individual components of that spread spectrum signal on the screen. So with an ordinary spectrum analyzer, I think Eric is very right. Knowing what you're looking at is difficult. And if it is a harmonic problem, if it's a 1.5 gig signal, I'm picking numbers out of the air, and the second harmonic is giving you the grief, is it pure front-end overload at the fundamental frequency that's doing it? It does sound like a new service has come into play with all these new frequencies that the cell sites have been buying, and we're going to have to live with it as I see it. And so we're going to have to find out which brand names and which models of RC equipment are vulnerable, and I think that's going to be your best defense for the time being. Go ahead and get Andy to the A2CDL to bring his 4-gig spectrum analyzer. Let me drop. Have him bring his 4-gig spectrum analyzer to Cedar Creek Park to see what he sees. But if he doesn't see anything, that doesn't mean that you've got a clean bill of health, if you know what I mean. Because the nature of the signals you're looking for are very difficult to see. Now, I think spread spectrum direct sequence is what's being used by the RC transceiver, the radio control equipment. Are the new services, the cell site services, using something similar, which is equally difficult to see on a spectrum analyzer screen? Is that part of what we're up against here, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW, and the TechNet?
Kind of sort of. Let me throw an additional wrench into this. If it's DSSS, or direct sequence spread spectrum, there is a specific sequence that has to be followed. And there is also a note, which is a synchronization note, so to speak. It's really a signal. So if you have something that's on the same frequency, it could, in fact, lock up to that transmitter's note and then, you know, making symbols the same time you're making symbols, that's going to create problems. That's one possibility. If the stuff is dual band, if it's both 2.4 and 5.6, chances are that it will probably start off doing ODFM because it's a better, more solid than the direct sequence spread spectrum. And if it finds difficulty with that, it'll switch back to the direct sequence spread spectrum, which, by the way, is a bit slower. But we're still talking decent speeds here, you know. Could be talking as high as 15 to 20 megabits per second easily. We're still talking an RF system as opposed to a piece of Ethernet cable or a piece of glass. So I happen to have a device that actually can pull those things out and actually show you the symbols that are being made. It shows everything around it. So in a traditional spectrum analyzer, if you've never seen what it really looks like, you're never going to see it.
It looks like broadband noise, almost Bart's head haircut. Is that true, Eric?
because the duration of the transmissions of each part, each transmission of the direct sequence is so friggin' short that half the time, because you may have the sweep rate on your spectrum analyzer, it's, say, you know, 200 milliseconds or 500 milliseconds, it comes and goes, and it didn't catch it.
Yeah, I call that the low probability of intercept problem. The spectrum analyzer at each millisecond is sweeping some region of frequencies. If the spectrum analyzer is sweeping the high end of the band, at the instant your direct sequence transmitter is producing a pulse at the low end of the band, nothing shows up. You don't get it onto the screen at all. Don't even see noise. So the good news is that these systems can allow you to have hundreds of aircraft in the air simultaneously. That's what Eric was talking about with the YouTube videos. I think they've got some synchronized aircraft that make all kinds of fancy lighting and positions. In other words, they fill up a whole volume of space with large numbers of these drone-like aircraft, all doing some kind of a synchronized maneuver. What's your guess, Eric, as to the maximum number of individual drones you've seen in some of those YouTube videos? And they're probably all on the same frequency region. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. I believe, I'm pulling this out of my memory. During the Olympics in Beijing, Intel had 450... No, they're not quad copters, they're six copters, whatever they call them, six hex copters, I think that's it. And all in the air, all at the same time, all of them with multicolored LED display to, essentially, they can make a billboard up there or make any kind of vector-based graphics and take up the entire stadium, so... Oh, and by the way, the government actually had to make sure that there were no Wi-Fi nodes within a certain radius of the arena, which is pretty cool. If you took, I'll find the URL. I'll send it to you. It's RWK2J.
450 aircraft, all being individually commanded to be into a certain position at a certain time, flashing a certain light-emitting diode color in this volume of space. Wow. What coordination that is. Imagine that radio control project, Mark. Into HVR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, it was all directed by computer.
I got the wrong guy. W2MST. Go ahead, Mark.
I have a hard enough time controlling one radio-controlled airplane, let alone 400 of them at the same time. That's quite amazing. So I guess in summary, as our discussion went on tonight, you suggested I give Andy a call, WA2CDL. But actually, I met with Andy about 25 years ago when I first got into the hobby. He helped me out with an HT that I wasn't operating properly. But it's been a long time since last I saw him, and I'm not quite sure how to get in touch with him.
By way of the list from ARRL, here, LIMARC. There's all kinds of ways by way of LIMARC. You go to the LIMARC website, find lots of ways of getting a hold of Andy. And Andy runs the tune-up clinic at every one of the LIMARC get-togethers. In fact, he was down in the Carolinas this weekend doing that exact service, doing a tune-up clinic down there. He's very good at that, so he's very well equipped. But whether or not he's going to have the exact answer for you, because you've got a fairly difficult problem of susceptibility, certain that Futaba has a known built-in susceptibility to these kind of signals that you're going to have to learn to live with from now on. So I think you're going to have to stop using that Futaba fast system. Is the beginning of a solution, as I see it. I'm going to go on to the next person who signed up to our list, was Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y. You've got it, Joe, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Let me step in here for a second. How do you spell it? I want to look it up.
How do you spell, what is that again?
Futaba?
Futaba, F-U-T-A-B-A. I think that's the spelling, F-U-T-A-B-A. Do I have that right, Mark?
That's correct. Strike Uniform Tango. Bravo Alpha.
Yeah, that's a brand of radio control aircraft that's been around for lots of decades, Eric. FUTABA. So, Futaba and Fast, I bet you're, with enough searching, that's going to give us an awful lot of information of why it has this additional susceptibility to crazy modulation and or frequencies that they're using and or front-end overload characteristics of their particular chip. WDRYY, you got it, Joe.
Okay. This is more, it's not really a question, it's actually just something I'd like to see if you can help participate in. First of all, what's the lowest power you can run on the transmitter you're transmitting on right now? How low can you turn that power level down to?
Right now, out of curiosity, I just turned it down to the 1 watt level. Joe, go ahead.
Okay. Number two, can the keeper of the castle turn off all the receivers except the main receiver in Glen Oaks? Can that be done for a couple of minutes?
What do you want to do?
Turn off all the receivers except for the main receiver, you know? You got three of them, make them go to one. Make just the main receiver. Just leave it on for a couple of minutes during this test.
Yeah, all right, give me a second.
The question has to do with the subject of repeater descents.
Okay, now you got just the main receiver. Nothing's going to switch.
Okay, well, I'm making 55 watts. Let's see how Dick sounds.
Yeah, my Yagi antenna is aimed at that site, and I'm running a minimum power right now. I'm hearing a little bit of hiss in the background. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, the other day I heard, just listening to the traffic on the repeater, I think K2KMB was on there, and he had cracklies on his signal. I believe he's from a base station. At a fixed base station, and it was quite noticeable, and I'm not sure if he's just typically hitting just the main receiver or something else in the system, but I think with you being able to run your power down a low power 1 watt, you might be able to, you know, see something like this happen and, you know, discuss about it. I know you said you put up an antenna, Eric, at that location, about a year or so ago. Possibly it might be going bad again.
All right, I got to throw another in chat here is that because we've been having difficulties with a certain kind of QRM, many times we turn certain receivers off, and sometimes people are not so strong into it, and it gets a little crackly. So you have to know what the circumstances were to just kind of make that judgment, you know.
It wasn't background RF noise as far as quieting the receiver. It was background crackling, like something was like had a loose connection. That's what I'm getting at. And I have an ear for that kind of stuff, so I know what I was listening to. But the two people in the conversation were completely oblivious to it. Didn't see that affect their conversation at all. They were just talking right over it. One guy didn't really have it, but K2KAB did have it now. I thought I just heard on me in the background here as I'm talking because I am fully duplex.
Well, do you hear it happening here?
I thought I just heard in the background as I'm transmitting on, you know, this radio.
Okay. I'm actually looking at the receiver at Fort Oaks. I'm going to increase the resolution. It's very small stuff, but hang on a minute.
So here's a question for you, Dick. Being that you're using a repeater that's transmitting on one frequency and listening on another, if the noise was coming from the antenna would be re-rating with broadband noise over the transmit and receive frequencies, and of course the duplexer is passing the receive frequency. If it was coming from just the transmitter itself, wouldn't that tend to be attenuated greatly on the receive frequency?
Okay, now would be the time for me to describe the so-called cracklies. When you get a station master-like antenna that's developing a solder crack between some of those individual sectors and the wind is blowing that antenna, Your transmitter is now generating amplitude modulated sidebands that are on the input receiver. They are on the input receiver frequency. So the transmitter with the amplitude modulation of the antenna is creating receiver frequencies. And as such, there's no way in the world you can filter that out, Eric. Joe, go ahead.
Okay. You're listening to yourself. Did you hear it on yourself? I thought I did.
Well, we're not getting cracklies tonight. If we had a defective antenna of this particular kind of defect on a windy night, and sometimes you'll also get it when you've got a certain kind of precipitation static on a thunderstorm-like night. But in either case, the receiver is looking for signals that are, let me pick a number, 120 decibels weaker than what's coming out of the transmitter. A sideband out of a transmitter, 120 dB down, is extremely easy to generate by way of the cracklings, you know, a loose solder connection and wind blowing the antenna, and or precipitation static at the antenna. So that very low level modulation, 120 dB down, 600 kc away, is generating a frequency on the input, and once you've generated the frequency on the input frequency, once you've generated the input frequency, there's no way in the world you can filter that out. K2LIW, you got it, Joe.
I realize that because it's going through the receiver from the path through the duplexer from the antenna, so the antenna is causing the problem, and it's generating broadband noise, and one of the frequencies generating it on is the receive frequency. That's the case of the crackling. I don't hear it on myself now. I thought I heard it earlier as I was transmitting. I thought I heard it on you earlier also. And I guess you're running a full 20-foot antenna up on the top of the building. If you find this to be the case, if the antenna is going bad again, would it be possibly something else to think about of running a shorter antenna, something made for extremely high wind environments, like a... what do they call it, a Super Storm King or something like that, that's shorter but built much, much more rigid as far as to handle wind loading and so forth. And I know these 20-foot antennas don't like to be tossed around the wind too much, and after maybe even a year or two, they start developing problems, especially on top of building up 600 feet above sea level.
I bet you there's various ways of guying that antenna or putting an adjacent pole alongside of it that grabs the top of the antenna and stops it from swinging in the wind. On my tower, there is one of those 120-foot long, one of those 20-foot or 18-foot long antennas, and it's got a piece of PVC pipe grabbing the top of it and holding it so it can't swing, and therefore you get ridiculously long longevity. You just got to stop the antenna from swinging in the wind, as I see it. Eric, you want to make any comment on all of the above? EJ, K2IW.
Yeah, I'm looking at the IF and receiver. I'm seeing something that looks a little bit like defense. I see it so much on my signal. I saw it quite a bit on yours. It actually looks like a very slight dip in the RF carrier. Now I'm seeing little positive going spikes in the receiver. I don't know. Time I go up there, I will take a look at it. When you come back, give me a dead carrier. Let me see what that looks like.
Okay, here comes some dead carrier.
That's enough. And by the way, somebody just tried stepping on you, or sending CW.
I heard him. Do you have any other question or comments that... Go ahead.
No, Dick, I don't. I thought this test would be a little difficult to pull with the yo-yo out there on Oceanside, but I guess that's the way it is sometimes.
Noticing the band being open, I hear the, about 2 meters, I hear Philadelphia. I heard a phone from earlier today. I just wondered if Joe's been doing any DXing lately, because I've been able to pick up Philadelphia a couple times, but not in the past day or so.
I've gotten to Philadelphia. That's an easy one. On 17, RF-26, RF-42. I've got those are easy ones. I got Channel 6 the other couple of mornings ago. But much, much further away than that, I've gotten also recently, very recently, RF Channel 19 from the middle of Virginia and RF-48 from Washington, D.C. How's that for DX?
That's cool. No, I got a Maryland station once. By the way, Channel 18 right now, their transmitter at Empire blew up, so they don't have their multiple streams, and they're transmitting out of West Orange. Warren, New Jersey.
I notice their signal's down because my antenna right now is pointed at 235 degrees, and I don't get them off the, not pointing at them anymore. I usually do, but I figure something's wrong with the signal and have the interference, but that's a good thing to know. Good thing they have a backup, right?
Well, actually, it's a synchronous the two transmitters run together, covers that back end part of New Jersey. So, let me turn this off. It's somebody being a dumbo. Okay. I was just curious because you got me into it. I started doing it.
Like a narcotic, you know?
Thing, because, you know, it's like flying blind. When I used to do it when it was analog, you could kind of tune it in, or you could see, I can see the thing flies! Yeah, and then you tune your antenna and get it, and you almost get a picture. And this is like, at least I have a receiver where I can control the receiver by RF channel number as opposed to having to dial in .1, .2, .3 and hope the heck the receiver knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, back in the analog days, I did that too, and you had to usually listen on the hour or half hour as you're getting the interference, so you can see the other caller that bleed through either in a negative or something like that. Aha, I got it, you know? And hopefully it would hang in there for that 30-second period of time that you could nail it as what you think you got.
Yeah, when I would get enough signal, I could turn the ghost eliminator on and actually read the data that they were sending in the bits, so I had the ability to do that.
See how much fun TV DXing is, Dick? Someday you'll be up there, too. You can go there with the next guy. I'm done for now.
In the old analog days, as you aim the antenna at the real source of the signal, you watch the sync bars getting stronger, you watch the snow getting weaker, and so on. With modern-day digital receivers, either get a signal or you don't get a signal. So aiming the antenna and peaking it on a digital signal is a hell of a lot more difficult. Is there any good solution to that you know from Paris, KEQEJ, K2RIW?
Turn your power up or use the secret sauce. There are some receivers that actually have a meter that the first part of it is actually reading the IF signal strength, and then the next part of the meter starts to really, even though it goes increasing in numbers, what it is, it just starts at a very high error rate, and as it gets up to the top, the error rate diminishes. So you can actually point your antenna. While there's a signal there, it may not be strong enough to lock up, but you can still find the source while you're tuning it, moving your antenna back and forth. And sometimes you just do that and wait, and by magic, the picture appears.
I guess if I got the right kind of receiver, I can tune to a minimum bit error rate. Okay, it's time we go over to Science Talk. So, AC2GS, Roy? Go right ahead. KQRIW in the Tech Tech. You've got it, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS. And just to remind everyone, if you want to suggest a topic or a question or a disputed comment that I made, The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, everything that I mention is going to be listed with links on a webpage called roy.ac2gs.com. And keep in mind, though, don't go searching for an email address on that page, because then you'll look at a web host who isn't me. So if you need to contact me, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, I maintain a little chat room here and watch people and answer questions if they ask them of me, and that's at chat.ac2gs.com. So let me drop for a moment and find out if I'm dropping out once again.
You're sounding very good. Some tiny dropouts, but not to worry.
Okie doke, let's begin. As Paul mentioned last week, NASA has detected that there's water ice on the surface of the moon, and future expeditions could harvest it for human settlements. They used data collected by NASA's Moon Mineralogy Mapper instrument aboard India Chandrayaan-1 spacecraft to prove its presence and find ice deposits at the moon's poles. The idea that Earth's natural satellite has pockets of ice hiding in the shadows permanently hidden from the sun isn't anything new. Previous probes sent back data containing evidence of their existence. However, NASA says this is the first time scientists have directly observed definitive evidence that there is water ice on what people previously thought was a barren space rock. Let me drop for a moment. According to the paper published by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, NASA's Moon Mineralogy Mapper was able to pick up the reflective properties you'd expect from ice at the moon's poles. It also measured the way the material's molecules absorb infrared light, which differs between liquid and solid ice, ensuring that those deposits were actually frozen water. NASA's Moon Mineralogy Mapper data showed that these pockets of ice were sparsely distributed at the northern pole and more concentrated at the southern pole. Those ice deposits most likely formed because the temperatures at the moon's poles, where sunlight never hits, don't go above minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit. Before we can count on them to sustain future manned missions, though, we first have to confirm how big and deep they are. Unfortunately, NASA already canceled the Prospector, a rover that was supposed to look and dig for ice and other resources on the moon that future manned bases could have used. The agency will still send the vehicle instruments aboard other landers, but that might delay discoveries that could have made sooner if they equipped it on a single rover. Let me drop for a moment. The thing that confused me about this story first is that the Chandrayaan-1 spacecraft was launched way back in 2008. That's 10 years ago. And due to sundry malfunctions, it was prematurely shut down earlier than planned in 2009. That was the last time I had contact with it. So, is it recycled? And if so, didn't I hear about it 9 years ago? Let me drop for a moment. The Chandrayaan spacecraft is very small. It's a cube about 5 feet on each side, about half the size of a small car. NASA assumed that the little spacecraft was still orbiting the moon, but without any contact since August 2009, how would you find such a tiny thing so far away? It's about 237,000 miles away from us now. Well, not surprisingly, NASA loves a challenge, so they decided to find where Chandrayaan-1 might be. Rather than try using something like a police radar gun, they were going to try something a little bit bigger, like NASA's 230-foot antenna on its Goldstone Deep Space Communications Complex in California to send out a powerful beam of microwaves directed towards the moon. Then they plan to listen for radar echoes bounced back from the small spacecraft still in lunar orbit received by the 330-foot Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia. Figuring out where to even look for the tiny spacecraft was a problem. The moon isn't as simple a structure as it seems. Gravitational forces, as the spacecraft orbits over the past 9 years, had to experience changing gravitational forces from the non-uniform ground below. Let me drop for a second. The radar team utilized the fact that the spacecraft was in polar orbit around the moon, so it crossed above the lunar poles on each of its orbits.
So on July 2nd, 2016, the team pointed the Goldstone Green Bank antenna at a location about 100 miles above the moon's north pole and waited to see if they could detect it. Chandrayaan-1 was predicted to complete one orbit around the moon every 2 hours and 8 minutes. Something that had a radar signature of a small spacecraft did cross the beam twice during 4 hours of observations. The team used data from the return signal to estimate its velocity and distance to the target, and the information was then used to update the orbital predictions for Chandrayaan-1. It turned out that we needed to shift the location of Chandrayaan-1 by about 180 degrees, or a half cycle from the old orbital estimates from 2009, said Ryan Park, the manager of JPL's Solar System Dynamics Group, who delivered the new orbit back to the radar team. But otherwise, Chandrayaan-1's orbit still had the shape and alignment that we expected. Let me drop for a moment. So they found a small spacecraft, but it was still deactivated. It was a lifeless object orbiting the moon. Where the heck did the spacecraft's moon mineralogy mapper data suggesting the ice at both poles come from? Well, in the end, it had really nothing to do with finding the small spacecraft. As interesting as the story is, NASA had just gone back to the moon mineralogy mapper data from back in 2009, reanalyzed it, and found the solid ice. So it's a circuitous trip to our final destination, but for me at least, I found it a very interesting detour. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Had anybody planned on a possible reactivation of that spacecraft once they found out where it was? Or is that out of the question from what you know, Eric? I mean, Roy, go ahead.
I tend to doubt it. They were having problems with it from the get-go. It was suffering from thermal environments that it apparently weren't tolerating very well. As it rotated around from one pole to the other, and the heat went up and down and up and down, and it wasn't really good for its electronics, and that was the reasons why they ended up deactivating it earlier than they had planned to. So I don't think anyone really is thinking about trying to turn it back on.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, very good. I remember reading about a little bit about them using the Green Bank telescope to, you know, pick up the signal to confirm that that was there. But that was a good story. That was a more complete story. That spacecraft was India's first spacecraft to orbit the moon. First successful flight for them. And now they have another one coming up late this year or early next year, which is going to involve a lander and a small rover. So, yeah, they lost interest in the first one because now they're going to be into the new one. As far as I know, that one is dead. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, Eric.
All right, I don't mean to interrupt your flow, but I just made an experiment here. I'm just 200 feet up. Oh. And, the other receivers are dropping out. Now, this is the case that I'm picking it up. And, Dick, what I would see you to do is talking. Turn, if you're listening to the input side, turn your receiver squelch up so he goes away, and then just crack it back to you just him and monitor him that way and see if you notice anything. Back to you, Dick, and then the voice.
Okay, I'll give it a try, but I'm not hearing Roy as strong on the input tonight as I did last week. So I'll try giving it a try. I'll go back to you, Roy.
Okay, but... they're building it much more sturdy than because it was a wonderful idea. The premise was great. There were nice scientific probes placed into it. Let's all be hopeful for the next one. Would you like me to just kind of give a blank carrier, or would you like me to talk or not talk before I get fixate on this dropout, which is okay. hopefully get to what's causing the dropout, that would be great. I'd love to go back to my flex.
That person is a very sick individual, and there's a characteristic of the signal that kind of gives it away.
Yeah, I think we all know who it is. So anyway, is there anything in for me to do to assist in finding what the dropout might be caused by? Anything you particularly want me humming a tune, saying words, saying nothing? I'm at your service here.
I recommend you just continue with the space talk. I mean, the science. Go ahead and hit the science talk.
By the way, does he have UHF capability?
Yes, he does.
Yes, I do. Would you like me to act?
Do you know where to go?
I'm not sure. I just know the public way to go. There might be a private way I'm not aware of.
Dick, is he aware of where you usually go?
You could send him an email telling him to go first.
Yeah, okay. I'll do that.
But I'm able to see that signal jumping around out there.
You can end up just like Jack Garrison.
Well, it's relatively close to you.
Sweeping frequencies, isn't that cute? So off a little while until I get the message email.
It's coming. I'm just picking the right one for you.
I've never gone that low.
All right, well, tell me if it doesn't work, then I'll give you something up high. I'm going to send it to you now. I got to run out to the car and turn it on, but that'll be another one.
Okay, is this duplex or is this simplex?
Oh, it goes both ways. Oh, my mistake. The very first one I gave you was simplex. It's only it.
Eric, when you get a chance, put me on the distribution. I might need an update.
I'm sorry, Dave.
What you're sending to Roy, put me on the distribution also. I might need an update.
Oh, okay, I'll send it to you in a minute. I gotta go try.
It's such a shame this has to be endured.
Okay, Dick. Crazy. Second, I'll send you.
Roger.
PGS, can you hear me? All right, can you make any of them? You're going to answer on two minutes.
Let me just dial it in a moment.
Okey-dokey. Let me send off to Dick here. Hey, Dick, does it need to go to IAW products?
You can go to any of my free emails. I get them all.
You should be getting it now.
Net tonight at 8.
Well, you should have made one of them.
Well, I tried all three, but I assume you haven't had any of them.
Could you make any of them?
Okay.
Try it again, we still got more problems. Go ahead, Dick, you know where to go.
Yes, of the frequencies you gave him, this is the first one.
This is the second one.
Make your choice.
Yeah, I'm much louder on the first one, but it has a significant amount of latency to put me into stuttering.
I got three different. Yeah, I don't know what's going on with voice. Made the last one.
Yeah, here I am on the last one.
Well, it works fine.
Yeah, the first and the last have latency. The middle one, no latency, but I'm noisy on that one.
You can stay there if you want. Yeah, there's no latency in it.
Roger.
Like we may have bored you. My mistake.
Yeah, I made a transmission that may have confused you.
Multiple times. I could hear you and Dick, but you apparently couldn't hear me.
Oh, that's a problem. I have to fix that. Well, I'll leave this up. Good luck.
Very much. I guess hopefully I feel lucky tonight. So let's go on with the next one, and hopefully everyone will behave. Let me drop for a second, and then we'll move on. Okay, a few weeks ago I was talking about so-called flat earthers, and I found a few more professionally produced reputations by people that have a lot of fine YouTubes on their channel. And the first one was done kind of tongue-in-cheek, while the second is a more sober refutation of the concept. So I've posted links to these YouTube videos for those that might enjoy them on my good old website, roy.ac2gs.com. Hopefully some of you guys will enjoy it. It's a little weird, but it could be amusing in times. Let me drop for a second. Okay, there's a piece of art called Descent into Limbo in a nice Portuguese museum by an artist by the name of Anish Kapoor. It appears to be a solid, blacker-than-black circle measuring about 3 feet in diameter. Although reportedly surrounded with warning signs and staffers warning visitors not to get too close, there was no barrier around it. Almost everyone has seen those old Looney Tune cartoons, where the cartoon character scribbles an ink black circle into the landscape and then escapes through it as if they've drawn a bottomless hole. The circle in the museum was very black, without the slightest hint of a reflection. Was it just an ink black circle, or was it an abyss? Let me drop for a second. Wouldn't you know it, someone had to find out for themselves. A 60-year-old Italian gentleman visiting the museum took a big step. And unlike those Looney Tunes characters that hover in midair until they look down to realize that nothing was supporting them, this gentleman fell straight down through the force of gravity immediately and fell into an 8-foot-deep pit painted very, very black. The gentleman took a few weeks to recover, and perhaps he won't step on black circles on the ground again. Now, although the artist used ordinary, very black paint in 1992 for this work of art, he has since obtained exclusive artistic rights for a new wonder material called Vanta Black. Vanta is an acronym for vertically aligned nanotube arrays, and Vanta Black is composed of a forest of vertical nanotubes grown on a substrate using a modified chemical vapor deposition process. Instead of light reflecting off this material, as almost every object does to one degree or another, almost all the light is absorbed by this material. Approximately 99.965% of all the visible light that reaches it is absorbed and converted into heat. Let me drop for a moment. Suffice it to say, Vanta Black is a lot blacker than the paint that that artist used back in 1992. And now that he's armed with this new blacker-than-black pigment, I would generally suggest that if you find yourself with a jet black circle on the ground in any museum or anywhere else for that matter, steer clear for your own good. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okie doke, talking about mysterious black holes, there seems to be a 300 million light year long region in space which seems to be missing something. Scientists observed an opaque region of space in front of a quasar, an extra bright source of light in the far distance. They realized that this light blocking region had fewer galaxies than expected. The region sits in front of a quasar called Eulis J1048+0600, whose light left on its journey to us when the universe was less than a billion years old. This area seems to absorb light for a stretch of over 300 million light years. The team of scientists used the Subaru telescope in Hawaii to hunt for distant galaxies around the opaque region and found far fewer than average, according to a paper published in the Astrophysical Journal. This is the opposite of what you'd expect. It shouldn't be opaque areas have more matter in them, is the question that scientists have. Let me drop for a second. Astronomers view distant objects via their Lyman alpha emissions. These are light emitted by hydrogen atoms with a characteristic wavelength. The light traverses the expanding universe, causing its wavelength to stretch along the way. But stuff in the intervening space, specifically neutral atoms, can absorb the light and cause certain wavelengths to go missing from the signal received on Earth. By plotting the wavelength of light coming from a distant quasar, you can make a map and timeline of the intervening stuff. The research team explained that electrically neutral gas absorbs the Lyman alpha light, but ionized gas atoms that have missing electrons do not. The region of the universe nearest to us is relatively uniform, and there's lots of ultraviolet light to keep the gas ionized and prevent absorption. But in the early universe, things were perhaps not as uniform. Maybe places with more galaxies had more ultraviolet radiation, meaning more ionization, and those areas were therefore more transparent. But regions like the one in front of this quasar had fewer galaxies, meaning less ionization, and were therefore opaque. It's an interesting observation that's counterintuitive in several ways. The exciting bit is that it is a very large structure over which there's something different about it. An astronomer not involved in this report opined, there should be the same number of galaxies in one region as another, yet in this case, there are not. Let me drop for a second. Perhaps this region tells a story of the reionization epoch, the period early in the universe's history after the first stars formed and exploded in supernovae, ionizing neutral gas molecules. Perhaps certain regions of the sky entered this period later than others. There's more work to be done to explain this mystery, and this region is just one portion of the enormous sky. If this idea is correct, then regions of the sky with more galaxies at this distance could have less Lyman alpha light absorption. But while the laws of physics remain constant, they really do seem to be parts of the universe different from the rest. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to our next, and we're going to talk about something that I'm sure not everyone's heard of, the Boötes Void. Mind you, this is not the only place where less seems to be happening than our theories might suggest. There is a fascinating region called the Boötes Void. It isn't that something incredible is going on there. It's more that less seems to be going on there than we would have guessed. The Boötes Void, otherwise known as the Great Void, is an enormous, nearly spherical-shaped region of space containing very few galaxies. It's located in the vicinity of the constellation Boötes. The Boötes is nearly 330 million light years in diameter. That's approximately 0.25% of the entire diameter of the observable universe, or approximately 236,000 cubic megaparsecs in volume. The Boötes Void is one of the largest known voids in the universe and is referred to as a supervoid. It was discovered in 1981 as part of a survey of galactic redshifts. The center of the Boötes Void is approximately 700 million light years from Earth. Let me drop for a moment. The void contains only a few galaxies. By 1997, the Boötes Void was known to contain only 60 galaxies. According to one astronomer, the scale of the void is such that if the Milky Way had been in the center of the Boötes Void, we ourselves would not know that there were other galaxies until as late as 1960. With only 60 galaxies, the Boötes Void is almost empty. Using a rough approximation of about one galaxy every 10 million light years, there should be approximately 2,000 galaxies in the void. The existence of this massive void does not seem to violate any current theories. It has been theorized that the void was formed from the merger of smaller voids, such as soap bubbles, coalescing to form larger bubbles. This would account for the small number of galaxies that populate a roughly tube-shaped region running through the middle of the void. But if you guys have a better reason, a better answer, there may be a Nobel Prize waiting for you in Sweden. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okie doke, on to the next. Many scientists are fascinated by gravity, especially at extremes. Will our present theory regarding it break down at infinitesimal masses or infinitesimal distances? What about antimatter? Would antimatter fall down just like regular matter? Or would it fall up? Or maybe if we are very desperate for grant money, wouldn't it be interesting if it turned out to fall sideways? Well, repeatedly, antimatter continues to behave just like regular matter, no matter what test scientists throw at it, and in the face of yet another challenge, antimatter again has refused to crack. Let me drop for a second. In a new study, physicists attempted to find differences between matter and antimatter, confusingly also a kind of matter, but with opposite charge and other differences. It's like an evil twist. Confusingly, the universe has way more matter than antimatter, for no clear reason. Physicists haven't found the specific differences they were looking for when studying the antimatter version of hydrogen called anti-hydrogen, but they have demonstrated a way to study antimatter better than ever before. Every particle has an antiparticle with the same mass but opposite charge, like its mirror image. Immediately after the Big Bang, there should have been an equal amount of matter and antimatter particles. When the two meet, they annihilate into energy, leading people to say things like, the universe shouldn't exist. But for some reason, the particles that make up you, me, the Earth, the Sun, and virtually everything we see are mostly ordinary matter. Only one in every billion particles in the universe is antimatter, according to CERN. Let me drop for a second. Scientists hoping to understand antimatter have a tool at their disposal called the antiproton decelerator at CERN. This machine produces and slows the proton antimatter counterpart, the alpha, known as the anti-hydrogen laser physics apparatus, combines these antiprotons with positrons, the antimatter counterpart of electrons, to form an anti-hydrogen atom. Once the trap the anti-hydrogen atom.